Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is conquest of fear. We might say fear is a hydra-headed enemy of modern man. Hydra is an organism with probably hundreds and thousands of tentacles. So also, we find there are a variety of fears. In fact, no book on psychology is complete without having a chapter which deals with fear, psychological fears called phobia, and anxiety called neurosis. So there are people who are afraid of open spaces. It is called agoraphobia. People who are afraid of closed spaces called claustrophobia. Then there are people who are afraid of heights, afraid of water, afraid of fire. And we find that in many cases, these fears can be traced back to some traumatic experience during person's early years or even during childhood. Generally, there is the tendency of parents, elders, nurses, ayahs to make the child do something by instilling fear into him. So they would say, if you don't finish this food, boogeyman will come. If you don't finish homework, then there is a threat given that he will be locked up in a bathroom. Now, HPP points out that these fears, they are not just restricted to childhood time, but they make a very deep impression in the psyche of the child and therefore are lying somewhere in the unconscious, subconscious, and they may surface any time during his adult years. So much so that it can lead to insanity. So in our first quotation, we are told, crying children frightened into silence by the suggestion of a monster, a devil, standing in the corner by a foolish nurse, have been known to become insane 20 or 30 years later on the same subject. There are mysterious secret drawers, dark nooks and hiding places in the labyrinth of our memory, still unknown to physiologists, and which open only once, rarely twice in a man's lifetime, and that only under very abnormal and peculiar conditions. Of course, there are also fears which could be traced back to one's previous lives. In one case, which is an actual happening, the girl was very, very frightened of water. She would scream as soon as a tap of water will be started or opened. Now, she had to be taken to a past life regressor, regressing her back to one of her previous lives. It was found that in one of these lives, she had seen her sister being strangled and thrown beneath a waterfall by her lover. And that when she screamed, he was going to do the same with her, and so somehow she escaped. Now that really left a very deep impression. So sometimes the fear which is there in a particular life, where a person is burnt by fire, then that fear can actually be impressed in every sheath of the soul. All the coverings of the soul can be impressed with the deep impression of the fear for water, fear for fire. And then in some life you see people having instinctive fear for fire, instinctive fear of water, and so on. But as we said, there are fears and fears. People who may not be afraid of anything else, they are afraid of public opinion. A woman often remains in an abusive relationship because she worries. What will people say? People will talk about it. This public opinion, in a way, is the voice of the people. It is the voice of majority. And we do find that there are many people who like to conform to this voice of majority. In many things in life, we are actually getting dragged by the majority because there is a fear. Fear of being excommunicated, fear of being thrown out of the caste, fear of being isolated, fear of swimming against the stream, swimming against the current. So much so that finally it leads to what a whole book has been written by Eric Fromm called The Fear of Freedom. It sounds like a paradoxical thing. How can anyone be afraid of freedom? We are all looking for freedom. But he does point out that we think that we are making choices, but the power of choice that we have used that power to make those choices which have sanction of majority. And therefore, right from our choice of books, whether it is painting, music, all the time, we want to conform to the majority. And therefore, if you hear a piece of music which is by, say, Bach or Beethoven, and you have no ear for it, if you are shown a painting by Van Gogh or Botticelli, and probably you have no taste for it, you read Charles Dickens and Jane Austen, and probably you don't like, but you will say, oh, it was a lovely book, it is a lovely painting, because it is a mark of good taste to appreciate Botticelli or Van Gogh or Jane Austen. And therefore, he says that the similar thing we do even in making the choices of our career, our profession. Early days, people used to look down upon someone who would become an actor or actress or a dancer. And today we see most of the boys and girls, they want to become choreographers, they want to become cricketers, they want to become football players. These are the professions which are chosen more and more because it has sanction of majority. And so, in fact, Mr. Eric Fromm says that it is not as if we want it. We want what we are supposed to want. In a way, we are just swimming in the direction of the stream. We dare not go against the stream. There is also the fear of losing our wealth, fear of losing our position, fear of losing our name and fame. Now, this we find as very graphically illustrated by Sangharakshita, that in that we are like a hawk. A hawk finds from somewhere a juicy piece of meat, and he carries it in the beak and is hoping that he will settle in a secure, peaceful place where he can enjoy this piece of meat. But very soon he sees hundreds of other hawks will follow. Some will peck at his body, some at his eye, trying to snatch away that piece of meat. Now the same thing is true. Anyone who is in possession of a lot of wealth or a powerful position, he is all the time in the worry, in the danger, in the fear of being toppled down, of being looted, of being murdered. So there is constant fear in which that person, as it were, lives. Now, we do find that therefore, somehow or the other, it has become very difficult for us to trust people. HPB, of course, says that you will not have to worry if you start trusting people. Now, here we have, with right knowledge, or at any rate with a confident conviction that our neighbors will no more work to hurt us than we would think of harming them, 2/3 of world's evil would vanish into thin air. Where do we have this confident conviction that others are not out there to harm us? In fact, we seem to be living in a sort of fear culture. Whoever had ever heard before that each building should have a security guard? Not one, but sometimes 2, 3, 4, and so on. Whoever had heard that if you travel by train in a ladies' compartment in first class, there must be a cop, there must be a policeman 24 hours. Whoever had even heard that if you keep a servant to do your work, you must have his or her photograph, find out about from which village he comes from what is his full address, his background, and so on and so forth. Now we see that variety of fears are coming up, and in fact it looks as if no one can be trusted. Who knows? The person who looks innocent and a very simple one turns out to be a murderer, turns out to be a rapist, turns out to be a terrorist. So the whole fear culture has gripped us. Now this one reason is the increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots, which HPB speaks about in the Key to Theosophy, where she says, the haves, the rich people, they have failed in doing their duty towards the have-nots, the poor. And what do we see today? There are temptations galore. So many temptations are there. You just switch on the television and there are at least 5 to 10 brands of chocolates, biscuits, apparels, gadgets, and whatnot. The poor has to be satisfied only by looking at them. And as someone has said, we have somehow aroused the desire of people, but we have not done anything to fulfill them. Then what do we expect? What happens then is that by hook or by crook, they want to also have their pleasures and satisfy their desires. And so there is looting, murdering. The senior citizens, they live in a constant fear of being murdered or some or the other thing. Now, this is one of the reasons. And therefore, one of the things which can become an antidote to fear of losing things, which is as on account of having a lot of wealth and property and things like that, would be to turn to what is now gaining momentum, the culture of minimalism. From being consumerist, we have to become minimalists. And we are in fact told that in Japan, in America, in India, more and more youngsters are turning minimalists, which would mean that he would have only 2 pairs of jeans, 3 or 4 shirts, 1 pair of shoes. He would buy a book, read it, and then donate it somewhere. Minimum things, of course, it is inspired by a Japanese writer, but as rightly pointed out by an author, our own Mahatma Gandhi was a minimalist, always emphasizing simple life. He used to go to the extreme of saying that the food I eat, no one else can eat. And therefore, if you are found to be possessing a thing which you are not using, which you have no need of, and still you are having it in your cupboard or in the house, it may not have been stolen originally, but it must be regarded as stolen property, because you have deprived it, as it was snatched it away from another man. It could have been of use to him. So this, if we follow, there would be in a way more or less even distribution of wealth, even distribution of these things of pleasure. One of the reasons for looting and criminality could be eliminated, and with that the fear also would go. As one of the students who used to live a simple life, and still his wife would say, have you locked things properly? Are the windows shut? Some robber can come. And he would very humorously say that if the robber came to our house, he would see we live in such want that he would want to leave something behind and then go. Now, that is true. If we really don't have any possession, we need not be afraid. That is just one little aspect. Side by side with this, today, people are also asking, what is the greatest threat to humanity? What should we be most afraid of? And here we see that answers given are, it is terrorism, it is pollution, it is global warming, it is artificial intelligence being used in warfare, and so many things. But Stephen Hawking, along with these reasons, he also says, it is stupidity of man That is what is a great threat, and we should be afraid of that. The stupidity, by that he means probably the misconceptions, misunderstandings, wrong ideas. And we know that when there is not the right ideas, right philosophical and religious ideas, right ideas about man, right ideas about God, we see there more wars, communal violence on account of the wrong ideas. But we can go a step further, in fact, and say that what is the greatest threat? Or we should be afraid of what? We should be afraid of the mind which is not rightly directed and guided. In fact, we find that in our reading today from Dhammapada, Buddha says that what an enemy can do to an enemy, what a hater can do to a hater, a wrongly directed mind can do you greater harm. And in fact, we find that the root of every other kind of fear is mind. There is this very simple aphorism: sow a thought and reap an act. Sow an act and reap a character. And we know how Dr. Radhakrishnan coined the word, crisis of character has set in. And that is what is behind the downfall of civilization. So, when there is a moral degradation because of wrong thoughts and wrong behavior, no wonder there are situations created for fear. And we have Sri V.P. Vadiya writing, "The downfall of every civilization is caused by the weak morals of those who live in and by it. False knowledge and misuse of knowledge generally accompanies weakened morals. An unbalanced relation between knowledge and ethics, between mental capacity and moral responsibility, competition leads at last to wars and destruction. The greatest threat to humanity may be seen in such imbalance between knowledge and love, between head and heart, because without the balance there cannot be practice of altruism for the good of all. Religious feeling without knowledge develops fanaticism, hatred and war. Knowledge devoid of spiritual basis begets arrogance, enmity and war." So here we are. Mind then really becomes, as the Upanishads say, it is a cause of both bondage as well as liberation of man. Of course, in the Dhammapada we are also told that from desire arises grief and from desire arises fear. From craving arises grief and from craving arises fear. And we have self-identifying attachment for certain things, places, people, including our own body. And so there is, for some people, a great fear of death, because they feel that if this body is gone, then everything comes to an end. This solid thing, that is I, and that solid body is not there, then I cease to exist. So the self-identifying attachment for everything is the cause of fear, because there is constant fear of losing. And in a sense, if we can have detached attachment, if we can have at the back of our mind one of the truths given in Buddhism, that all conditioned existence is impermanent. So we live with that knowledge that my dear one, or this place where I live, or my money, sooner or later I will have to part from that. Then there will not be any fear. If there is no attachment, there will not be any fear. Now, coming back to fear and then fearlessness. How do we conquer fear? At a simple level, in fact, we have been told in cognitive behavioral psychology that those fears which are not deep-rooted, you can overcome them by confronting them, by facing them. So, we know that a person who is afraid of, say, water or drowning. He can take a plunge into water, of course. There must be a person somewhere around him to save him if something goes wrong. But once he takes a plunge into it, normally people learn how to swim. Vivekananda, while he was traveling in India as a monk, just to have an experience, at one place in Varanasi, he came across very brutal monkeys and he started running away. And someone, as it were, shouted and said, "Face the brutes." So he turned back and decided to face them. And with a lot of courage in his mind and heart, he started walking. And to his amazement, he found the monkeys simply disappeared. Of course, Vivekananda, being Vivekananda, learned the lesson that, well, that is true also of the difficulties of life. So long as we are afraid and we try to dodge them, run away from them, they become more and more difficult. But once we face them, manly way we face them, then they have to disappear sooner or later. Now, secondly, we find that there is this morbid fear, in a way, of the future. And therefore, we often say that don't cross the bridge even before you have arrived at it, which we term as anxiety. It is a form of fear, in a way. Now, regarding this, one of the methods suggested is that you could actually live it out in imagination. If I go and probably I'm insulted, probably I may not be able to answer. You can live it out, actually. So what? Even if these things happen, so what? In fact, we are told that this is something which was tried by Crosby in those early days when he was all alone and no one was by his side before he could start the first center of ULT. He says, "I used to look calmly and dispassionately at the very worst picture I could conjure up as happening to myself and found it helpful in getting rid of fear of consequences. I mentally took account of the very worst, saw myself in it with all that it entailed, went through it in all its parts, leaving myself alone, dishonored, stripped of everything. Those very things have happened to me, but I knew them and went on undismayed. Had I not done it, I would not be where I am today." So, we find that that is yet another way of overcoming your fear. But it is also interesting to see that when picture is drawn of a fearless man in Gita, in fact in the 16th chapter, there are demoniacal and there are daivi sampat. The godlike qualities begin with fearlessness. And who is a fearless person? Gita says, he is someone who is not afraid of anyone, but also no one is afraid of him. Now this is the crux of the whole matter. If we want to become fearless, we have to be such people that others are also not afraid of us. Here we can see that a magnetism, and what is that magnetism? It is nothing but the life energy streaming forth from the person, which is made pure or impure by the thoughts. And if we can start looking at our thoughts, controlling our thoughts, we can come to this position. A writer, a regular contributor to Life Positive magazine, writes at one place that one day during the monsoon season, she was sitting in her garden and she noticed an earthworm rapidly coming in her direction. She looked at the earthworm, but somehow the thought came when it was just nearing her that in the school and colleges we used to have experiments and we used to cut up the earthworm into two parts, and somehow the two parts would join themselves. And before she could think further, she found the earthworm turning back and moving away from her, finally hid itself under a leaf. Now she said that it really opened my eyes. If my thoughts could affect an earthworm in such a way, how much more impact it must have on other human beings. So then I decided there and then that I will have such thoughts so that I would have a positive aura around me. In my presence, people should feel loved, accepted, rather than being criticized and judged. In my presence, people should feel calm rather than agitated. Now, if every man were to make this resolve, we know it would go a long way, because finally, again, what is at the root of all the fears? It is a sense of separateness. Because each one thinks that we are separate from others and I have to take care of my own interests. If I think ill or if I think good, what is it to others? But if we can recognize this universal brotherhood and unity, there would be very little fear of any kind remaining. And that is why one of the authors has said, at the root of fear is the idea that we are fully independent beings. The more we become aware of the interconnectedness of creation, the more we can see that our own interests are inseparable from those of other humans and other beings. As we move towards that understanding, the world seems less frightening and more supportive. If we could react with less fear and more love, then surely the world would be a far safer place. Now, it is not as if fear doesn't have its own uses, though it is only a short-term gain. But sometimes fear also does wonderful work, as it were. After all, it is this very fear of public opinion which keeps people within the moral bounds. A man who would be tempted to have extramarital affair would think twice. Because of this fear, what would people say? These days, children who find their old parents burdensome and would be tempted to put them in old age homes, many of them desist from doing it because there is fear. What would people say? And then again, we know our cities and nations, most of the time the laws which are made, they are actually making use of fear in order to bring about a semblance of discipline. Either we will be fined or we will be imprisoned or there would be a kind of capital punishment and so on and so forth. So the laws also make use of fear. And similarly, during the early years of childhood, not all parents have time to make children understand. So they, as we have seen at the beginning of the lecture, they make use of fear so that the child would do what is required of him. Now, of course, this only serves short-term purpose. Our aim should always be to make people understand. After all, even religion makes use of fear. And we know how during Satyanarayan Puja, they would say, you can't leave it halfway. If you leave it halfway, some anishta, some very bad thing will happen. And in fact, they always invariably tell you a story of a woman who left it halfway in order to meet her son who was coming by a boat. And as soon as she left the puja, the boat started, or the ship started sinking. And when she finished the puja, it again came up. A senior student used to humorously say, the boat or the ship seems to be behaving like a badly managed submarine. So fear has always been used in order for people to accept the dogmas. The church used to instill fear of excommunication, burning at stake, or that after that you will go to hell. But this is not the right way. Because of the fear, people never develop the reasoning power. They only develop blind faith, not reasoned faith, not intuitive faith. But it is also true that of one thing we must be afraid, and that is the fear of Lord, God, or what theosophy calls law. See, the proverb of wise Solomon says, "The fear of Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." It is the beginning of wisdom. There are people who are literally not afraid of anyone, anything. They don't worry if their reputation is gone. They have lots of guns and lots of people around, so they are just not afraid of government or other people. And to what extent this fearlessness goes? It just makes them despotic. And they don't care about lives of other people, especially. We have got dictators and despots. They ruin the lives of all the people in the nation and also of people belonging to other nations and so on. Then what happens? This is something which happens because they are disregarding the law. They think, as again Gita says, "Where is another like unto me?" There is so much pride which comes as a result of this false sense of independence and fearlessness. And finally, the law has to step in. And Vadiaji calls this law of karma as Vajra, the thunderbolt. So here he says, "Increasing obstinacy weakens the will of such persons. Pitting themselves against the law, they are tossed hither and thither, are bruised and maimed by the Vajra, till at length they learn to fear the law that pardons only through punishment. Fear leads to search through knowledge. Then independence is given up, interdependence is recognized, and inspiration comes. Inspiration enshrined in the mantramic phrase, 'Work with the law.' When the lesson is learned, the necessity for punishment ceases and the protective aspect of Vajra is active. Vajra defends the oppressed while it strikes the tyrant." So, the fear of at least the law of karma is something which is desirable. Otherwise, we would not worry about what harm we are bringing to other people. There must be harmlessness within us. And that is why, as we said from Gita, that he is someone who is the fearless person. He is someone who is not afraid of anyone, and also no one else is afraid of him. If you go to see, there is in the pictures a saint or a sage is sitting, surrounded by lion, tiger. Sometimes if we see sitting near the lake, there are deadly alligators. And there is also side by side deer and rabbit and such creatures. Normally, we know a tiger would pounce on deer. Alligator would not leave any of them. And yet they all seem to be sitting in peace and harmony, because harmlessness within him radiates this harmlessness also around him, so that he puts the whole atmosphere into one of amiti, one of friendship and peace. So, if we say that fear can be conquered by courage, that courage is not brute strength, we would realize that there is a great difference between the strength of someone like Hitler and strength of Gandhiji. The strength of Hitler was like this person described. Lot of pride and arrogance, self-centeredness. Whereas courage shown by Gandhiji was spiritual courage. It was based on two things. Paradoxically, it was courage based on non-violence or ahimsa and satyagraha, absolute truth. He actually shook the very foundation of British Empire with these two weapons, so to speak. It is these which give, as it were, soul force. So, in a way, when we describe virya, dauntless energy, spiritual courage, moral force, we always say it is not to be manufactured. As soon as you are ready to surrender your personal will to the divine will, this energy will flow through you. In fact, I think in one or two issues back, there was the article on fasting. Mention was made of Gandhiji's rite of fasting. And there it was made very clear. Gandhiji himself used to say that don't try to imitate me. If my fasting produces a sort of a force, it is because I have undergone the prior training of living a pure life, living a non-violent life. Only when you are pure and non-violent can you really hope to have that impact, so that when you take up fasting, you stand against a robber or a criminal, you tend to disarm him. There is a soul force which flows. In fact, this is the idea which is also there, given by Mr. Judge, who says, resist without resistance. It is a plan of quiet, passive resistance. And he says, if one fights, then one is drawn into the swirl of events and thoughts. Instead of leaning back on the great ocean of the self that is never moved, leaning back on the great ocean of the self that is never moved. So you don't fight. It is plan of quiet, passive resistance. This is something which is also there in Lao Tzu's philosophy. It's a concept called Wu Wei or inaction. He says that you don't have to fight. You just retreat within your heart and stand there firmly still. What is really required so that this soul force will flow through you? It comes through in the very small example or a story which is put by Lin Yutang while explaining this inaction. He says that there was once this person who used to raise the cocks for fighting. There used to be cock fights. A king had given his cock for training. After 10 days, this king asked him, "Is the cock ready for fight?" And this man said, "No." And it's interesting to watch what are the characteristics of a person, what he should not have in him if he wants to have spiritual courage. So he says, "No, I can see he is still impulsive and haughty. So he is not ready for fight." After 10 more days when he is asked, he says, "No, he still reacts to noises and to shadows." After 10 more days he says, "No, there is a lot of fight in him. And there is anger in his eyes." And only after that he said, "Now he is about ready. When other cocks crow, he doesn't even react. He is almost like a wooden cock. Other cocks would look at him and will run away." This is the kind of force, this is the kind of energy we conserve, and it will flow through you. We are not going to be provoked, we will not be angry, we will not hate anyone, we will not be impulsive. It's only then Only then would you have that energy to fight anything. And that is why it is said, the best of soldiers are not warlike. The best fighters do not lose their temper. The greatest conquerors are those who overcome their enemies without strife. This is called the virtue of non-striving, wu wei, or inaction. The important thing is that we go closer to our own divine nature. We are asked to, as it were, rely on, or so to speak, lean back on the great ocean of life. So, that courage is the energy which flows from our own divine nature. And that is why we know that there are people today who are afraid of black magic. What will happen if a black magician will do something to me? If the ghost comes, there are paranormal happenings. What is really that force which will save you from such things? And we are told again and again that clear conscience with the desire to benefit humanity and all the time trying to remain close to your own divinity within you, it will work as a protection. As somewhere Mr. Judd says, he need not fear aught that heaven or hell holds. So, this is the force which flows from within. And we don't have to really do anything elaborate in order to become fearless. Fearless of worldly or otherworldly things. Virya is supposed to be the virtue which goes hand in hand with shanti. Patience. So, here we are told, keep right on and try for patience in all the very smallest things of life every day. And you will find it growing very soon. And with it will come greater strength and influence on and for others, as well as greater and clearer help from the inner side of things. Why should we be fearless? Especially when we want to live the spiritual life. It is said that fear kills the will and stays all action. You are, as it were, freezed. In fact, we are told that fear tends to congeal up the astral body. It shrivels it up. Instead of making it a coherent body which can be at will projected, it tends to get shriveled up. It has a freezing impact so that the will is paralyzed and we cannot really do the good things that we want to do. Similarly, in trying to develop intuitive perception, it is said that someone who is so afraid of what other people says and he is going to listen to other people, he can never develop intuitive power. So, in Light on the Path, we are told that only the person who is untamable, has indomitable will, who can play the Lord over things, people, places, save his own divinity, can hope to have intuitive power. So, for development of intuition, also we require that we must not have the fear of listening to what our higher nature says. For bringing about any reform in the society, in the people, we must have the moral courage. All the saints, all the great reformers, they were necessarily people with a great moral courage so that they could break the wrong customs, traditions, the narrow ideas and so on. And of course, there must be above all the courage to take a leap into the unknown. As again we are told in Through the Gates of Gold, that we cling to the familiar side of things. We are not ready to leave the comfort zone because we don't know what awaits us on the other side. And therefore, very few people begin the living of the higher life. But we need to have the courage to trust that unknown and take a leap, as it were. With taking courage in both our hands, we have to leap on the other side and start living the spiritual life. No matter how much pain it may bring, ultimately, it is all going to be bringing us ananda, unconditional happiness. But it requires courage. It is said that spiritual life is not for those who are timid, those who are afraid. It is for those who are courageous, and therefore conquest of fear of every kind is very, very important in walking the path.